Сегодня в центре Киева подорвали бомбой автомобиль, в котором находился полковник.
Уличная камера наблюдения фиксирует мощный взрыв. Машину буквально
погиб начальник резерва главного управления разведки Министерства
обороны
Украины.
Бомба сработала в автомобиле, которым управлял начальник управления.
Fighting escalates in the Donbass. One military intelligence officer is killed by a car bomb in Kyiv, and another is killed in eastern Ukraine. The three-year-old war between Russia and Ukraine appeared to be settling into a frozen conflict, but suddenly things seem to be heating up. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there.
And also with us in the studio is RFRL's Ukraine correspondent, Christopher Miller, who is fresh from a tour of the front lines in the Donbass. Welcome back, Chris.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And let's get the ball rolling with you, Chris. We've been hearing lately a lot about another escalation in the Donbass. Yet another ceasefire, the so-called harvest ceasefire, has failed. The Ukrainian side is reporting increased casualties. What are you seeing on the front lines? What is the situation on the ground, and how is it similar or different to what you've seen in previous tours?
In short, it's war, as it has been since 2014. Despite language like frozen conflict being used, there's nothing frozen about it. Maybe in terms of the front line and the border that's been drawn between the two sides, because that is fairly static today, but. Like clockwork, being on the front line out there, the fighting almost never ceases. You've got maybe a few hours every day where soldiers might take naps and rearm, and then sure enough, every dinner time it starts. Mm-hmm. Kind of a slow burn, small caliber weapons till night falls, and then the heavier stuff comes out. I would say yes, there has been an escalation. If you look at what's happened in the first 6 months of this year versus the first 6 months of 2016, and that's not just my anecdotal analysis, but that's based on the statistics of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, the Ukrainian military, the number of deaths logged by both of those groups and the UN all show that the violence is almost double the level it was the same time last year. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, during my time out there, I went to some of the places that were more recently flashpoints in the conflict, like Avdiivka, which, in February was pretty nasty. Also some places like Shirokina, for example, mm-hmm. which was a major flashpoint in 2015, and the town has been completely decimated, but there's still fighting happening there mm-hmm. on a daily basis.
So there's nothing, is there anything special about this escalation did you see anything to indicate that?
It's hard to pin down exactly why the escalation is happening now. I think early on this year, my sense in talking with some of the commanders on the Ukrainian side, because I haven't been on the DNR mm. side, the LNR side, that's the separatist side, for more than a year now, just mm. because they've almost completely stopped letting foreign correspondents in. They let in some people, but not those of us who spent a significant time at the mm-hmm. beginning of the conflict. My feeling and what I was hearing from people earlier in the year was a lot of uncertainty about what Donald Trump was going to be doing. At that time, he was still speaking very glowingly of Putin, and there was a lot of talk then about a deal being made with the Russians at Ukraine's expense. Right. And those talks have kind of...
There's less of that now.
There's a lot less of that right now. And that was, why I thought there was an escalation. Everybody kind of wanting to know how the U.S. was going to respond to an escalation, right? Would Trump come out and support Putin and make a deal, or would the opposite happen and he comes out in support of Ukraine and slaps Russia with stronger sanctions? And we've actually seen something maybe a little bit kind of in the middle, mm-hmm. Where Trump hasn't really done much on his own, but Tillerson mm-hmm. and the State Department have We've heard some strong language by Mattis, the defense minister, and Nikki Haley as well. And, of course, we saw some new sanctions slapped against Russian and Ukrainian officials and separatist authorities.
Well, we were talking off mic. You were saying there's more uncertainty in this conflict now than there has been at any time since the beginning. I guess that's more related to the political factors that we'll be discussing throughout the podcast as well, or is it to anything to do with what's going on the ground?
Yeah, certainly it's political uncertainty, but I think there is a lot of uncertainty on the ground as well. And a lot of times there's a disconnect between what's happening on the ground and what's happening in the capitals, and that still is very much there. But you know what some of the soldiers have told me is, look, it's summertime. We know historically the last 3 years, what we can count on is things heating up in the summertime. Mm-hmm. We're seeing an escalation right now that's, I think, maybe a little bit earlier than we saw last year, and maybe even in 2015. Now, by August, things will probably be pretty hot. We already saw an attempt at a ceasefire, yet another one, fail. Before it even got off the ground, it was over and done with. So, you know, there is a certain amount of certainty, right? These guys are certain that they're going to continue fighting,
right?
That it could, that it's very likely to get hotter. They are also uncertain of, you know, just what is going to be discussed at the G20, if there is going to be some kind of deal, because there's a lot of talk happening in Washington, in Brussels, and in Kiev, and surprisingly from Poroshenko himself, of a new way to go about approaching Minsk.
Right.
You know, keeping the goals somewhat the same, but trying to get there, you know, through a different route.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and we'll get into that in a lot deeper in the second half. Mark, I wanted to turn to you. What's your sense? We have a year on year, we have an escalation, but yet this has been, it's summer. It's time for an escalation as well. Anyway, what do you see happening?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would want to start by absolutely agreeing that this is war. I mean, I've kind of, with what might be an appropriate sort of lightheartedness, almost called this the Baked Alaska conflict. That precisely, it's frozen in the center in political terms, but at its border, it's still piping hot, absolutely. So we have to realize that. But nonetheless, it is interesting that we have seen this earlier escalation on the basis of a sort of a higher level of general sort of tempo of operations being driven by the Russians. And I've been trying to think, well, why might this be? And I've got a couple of suggestions. One of them is precisely that in a way, if we're coming up to G20 and various hints about the possibility of some different kind of configuration, it's about creating the new baseline, the new normal. And again, it's a very classic Russian tactic that in a way, if you know you're going to be bargaining, you try and get as far ahead as possible. So in some ways, you know, you sort of, you steal 100 and then you say, but we'll compromise and we'll only steal 50. So it could be that they're actually almost trying to create a new baseline.
But that would suggest they're going to take more territory.
No. I don't think so. Because actually, also, if one looks at this, none of these are the kind of operations that are precisely geared for major advances on the ground. And that would require something very different, given the scale of the Ukrainian rearmament process and such like. And also, it would once again focus things. I mean, I think that's a point where it would be impossible not to see sort of some, whether it's Americans or others, providing lethal military support and that kind of thing. No, I don't think that's the plan. But I think it's almost just like kind of trying to set the parameters for, this is our kind of normal, acceptable levels of behavior. We're willing to be haggled down to what is merely sort of, you know, half.
So she's shelling a couple of times a day. I mean,
yeah, exactly. I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but I mean, that is a classic Russian negotiating tactic. Second point I would make is, I think we've moved into a point where, and I know we're going to be talking, for example, about the recent spate of car bombings, but generally, I think the Russians are clearly creating a new strategy of tension. And I think there is almost a sense that for the Ukrainians, this conflict has become too bearable. In practical terms, in political terms, I mean, yes, there are all kind of tensions and so forth, but nonetheless, I think there is a sense that the Ukrainians are not hurting enough. And therefore, this is a way from the Russians at relatively minimal political and military cost to precisely, again, once again, make it a thing. Make it something which, exactly, people are coming home in body bags, that people are sort of worried about, you know, is my boy going to be sent to the front line? I mean, even though 75% of the Ukrainian military is contract, there are still sort of conscripts within the system. So it, one way or the other, I think it all fits together into a sense of precisely, we want to remind the Ukrainians why the status quo is a painful thing for them.
Well, let's go to that. Let's go to those car bombings, because, like, as you suggested, Mark, in addition to the fighting in the Donbass, this week also witnessed the killing of Colonel Maxim Shapoval, who a top Ukrainian military intelligence officer, in a car bomb in Kyiv. According to media reports, he was working on gathering evidence for a case at the International Court of Human Rights, the International Court of Justice in The Hague. There was a second car bombing yesterday in the Donetsk Oblast that killed another Ukrainian military intelligence officer. Two Ukrainian military intelligence officers. Significance, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, and we shouldn't actually... I mean, back in March, there was a lieutenant colonel of the SBU from the Mariupol counterintelligence division who was also killed in a car bomb. So again, I mean, this has definitely become a thing.
Pattern, right?
Now, this is... I mean, any individual killing... it's always possible to come up with a whole variety of different explanations for. I mean, Shapoval, I was told, again, who knows, but, you know, I was told by some that in some ways he was a little bit too honest for his position, given that, you know, that there is a fair amount of corruption and so forth. But, you know, one can point to any one, but it's clear, put it together, that this is a pattern, and it's hard not to assume that it's a pattern being orchestrated by the Russians.
So they're knocking off intelligence officers.
Yeah, and ones who are particularly inconvenient. I mean, Shapoval, it could be to do with this sort of, you know, preparing this dossier, or it could also be that in his role as, I mean, he wasn't SBU, he was basically head of
military intelligence,
and basically head of the Special Forces Intelligence, sort of their kind of active reconnaissance wing. In other words, the people who precisely can try and carry out direct on the ground razvedka, you know, reconnaissance intelligence in the Donbass.
A fairly high ranking. He's a full bird colonel.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I think he's also just someone who just might have got a bit too inconvenient. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's actually just, if people are too good, then it's worth picking them off. I mean, this is a classic strategy. I mean, even when one looks at, oh, heavens, I mean, how Mossad used to deal with the PLO. You don't go for the people at the top. You go for the extremely able, middle-ranking people. Mm-hmm. So this is exactly, again...
So this is targeting.
If I was sitting in the aquarium, if I was drawing up a targeting list, this is the kind of person I'd be going for. So, yeah, I mean, in this context, I think it fits two things. One is it's clearly trying to degrade Ukraine's intelligence and counterintelligence capacities. I mean, let's be honest, there is still a lot of penetration of Russian agents and so forth, but they're obviously trying to ensure that those people who are any good, they eliminate. And the second thing is precisely to fit this back to this business of a strategy of tension. There's something about a car bomb. A car bomb is not always the most efficient way of killing someone, but it is what in Cosa Nostra terms is a cowboying. It's a nice, big, demonstrative killing. Mm. No one, I mean, you know, even the very fact that we have CCTV footage of the car actually right. being blown up. I mean, this therefore makes it a media event as well.
And Shapoval was killed in the center of Kyiv.
Precisely. So, you know, it basically makes it into the whole theater of terrorism, which is really what you're aiming for. So, again, I think it's a combination of very practical reasons why you want a certain number of people dead, but at the same time trying to build up this sense. And if they can kind of whip up a whole kind of witch hunt mentality within Ukraine, or conversely, a sense of fatalism and misery about, oh my God, you know, you can't go out to the shops without worrying if the car you're walking past is about to blow up, then that's excellent from Moscow's perspective.
Well, that's starting to kind of that those feelings are starting to, you know, emerge. I mean, it began with the car bombing and assassination of Pavel Sheremet, the Belarusian-born, you know, Russian journalist in central Kyiv. And actually, to the end that you were speaking about, you know, these car bombings making, you know, being such a fearful public act, like certainly doing them in the center of the capital is obviously works quite well if you're trying to stir fear. And, you know, three more, two in, you know, fairly large cities. Mariupol is now the biggest city in eastern Ukraine that's still under government control. And then another one in the capital of Kyiv that was caught on CCTV footage. Konstantinovka is a, you know, small town near the front line, but not on the front line anymore in eastern Ukraine. And I think there's still a little bit, that's not quite clear about that, whether or not it was a bombing or a mine that they struck. I don't know for sure, but I think we should be a little bit careful there.
That's a good point.
You know, especially coming on the day, like accidents. I mean, accidents happen in eastern Ukraine all the time. There are thousands of mines. So just to be fair. But, you know, certainly two car bombings, as well as what the public assassination of Denis Voronenkov, the former Russian MP that, you know, a lot of people are also pointing the finger at Russia for, even though the assassin was a Ukrainian guy who is said to have crossed the border. I mean, that's certainly all of those things are stirring fear. And when you speak to journalists who cover these, or who were colleagues of Sheremets, for example, those of us who cover the conflict very, very closely, journalists who have been particularly critical of Russia's actions in Ukraine, you do get the sense that people are scared. There is a fear permeating through Kiev. At the same time, you can go out for cocktails on a Wednesday night and not feel any of that, right? There is this weird kind of distance that exists, and not every Ukrainian feels it equally, which can be a really bizarre thing, you know, living there right now.
Yeah, no, I did. This is one place I did want to go, because you live in Kyiv. When I go to Kyiv, it's just you can't help but be struck by the fact of, wait, this is a country at war.
Definitely.
You know, because Kyiv feels like a lot like a European capital in a lot of ways.
Well, there were times where it felt like the war was closer, right? And I know Mark wants to jump in, but just real quick, like, you know, in 2014 to early 2015, up until Minsk II, right? Until Debaltseve, the war was still somewhat visible, or at least could be felt as far back from the front line as Kyiv, and even Lviv, because boys were coming home in body bags. You know, there were rallies to raise money for the troops on the square.
Right.
Those things happen less and less frequently now, right? Money's still being raised, but they've moved online. It's not public anymore, and fewer people are coming home in body bags because while the conflict is still ongoing, they come home one or two at a time every week, not 12, 20, 200. You know, so there's that.
So Russia's bringing the war into the capital right now. Mark, I know you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I think I wanted to actually pick up on precisely something that Chris said. I mean, about the Voroninkov shooting, which I actually often have difficulty thinking of as a Russian state hit. I mean, in so many ways, it looks much more amateurish. It just doesn't look, it doesn't fit the parameters of how I imagine. But what this does speak to is, apparently, again, I'm playing with this concept of sort of dark power. The idea of a sort of the dark inverse of, if soft power is, we want you to like us, and therefore you sort of you mold your policy around another government's because you feel some pull and some affinity to it. I think given that, I think Putin has pretty much, for most countries, given up on the hope of basically making friends. In some ways, Russia actually, I think, has a still emerging strategy of precisely basically saying, well, if we're going to be the parental guidance, listen away, bastards, we might as well be the best and the most scary bastards around. And I think this is the great thing. Actually, now that they create a situation where people will assume.
Right.
I mean, yes, there are many times when the Russians really do it, and people will assume it. I mean, take, for example, there was the Balaklaya ammunition dump that sort of blew up. Now, I've heard a lot of people suggest that it's actually just very, very shoddy ammunition handling that led to an explosion. I mean, who knows?
Which I've seen firsthand in the front line.
You shocked me. I was assuming you were going to leap forward and defend the integrity of logistical handling.
Yes, the guy who shot himself in the foot with his Kalashnikov did so on purpose.
Exactly.
To prove a point.
That's
a shame.
Exactly. See, that they work. Mm-hmm. They work, damn it. Now, I mean, I think this is... But on the other hand, you know, the first assumption is inevitably something like that happens. Oh, my God, somehow the Russians were able to get into this, you know, relatively secure facility and blow it up. And I think, therefore, this is also part of, I think, the reason for the Russian strategy of tension. It's precisely, it creates an environment. The Russians cannot, without a massive deployment of force with massive negative consequences, directly bring the war to Kyiv. The days when one can think of a shock and awe offensive, right, which would see Russian tanks rolling into
down the Maidan,
whatever, exactly, they're long gone, frankly.
Right.
So instead, they're moving the battlefield. They're moving the battlefield precisely into these covert realms of fear and death, which is, after all, which they excel. I mean, it's worth mentioning that, you know, actually how many of these killings they have carried out in one form or another with no yet sort of clear evidence. No one's been caught or whatever. Right. Even the Voroninkov assassin was shot
was
dead.
Shot
he
dead,
wasn't
dude.
Actually caught. So, I mean, I think this is it. I mean, I do feel that this in some ways is the proving ground for how you operationalize this kind of dark power strategy. So, and try and create the point with a situation where every organized crime hit, every unexplained accident, anything like that, and people will think, oh my God, the Russians again.
Well, you know where I'm going to go now, because I was wondering if we were going to go here or not, but every cyber attack. Now, this week's cyber attack, which came on the same day as Shapoval's assassination, the first instinct in everybody, let's face it, me, everybody in this room, was okay, the Russians hit the Ukrainians again. After all, they hit them in December 2015. They hit them in December 2016. They've attacked the power grid.
2014 presidential elections
as well. And so it was natural to suspect the Russians. And then something weird starts happening, like Rosneft is getting hacked too. And the Dutch are getting that too, and
the French,
and so on. And then you start saying,
the U.S.
Maybe it wasn't the Russians, but now there's a lot of people in Kyiv who still think it was the Russians, and there's actually some increasing amount of cybersecurity experts who are taking another look at this and saying, it might have been the Russians. Now, I don't know, and nobody in this room knows, let's face it, but in the studio knows, but this fits into this whole dark power meme too, doesn't it? I mean, Russia's a winner here, whether or not they were behind that.
I know. Look, in the long term, it's incredibly toxic for Russia. It becomes regarded as kind of North Korea's first cousin in terms of kind of pariah state nature. But in the short term, and again, I think this is unfortunately the way that the Russians are thinking, particularly at a point where you feel that on Ukraine there may be some scope for some kind of new negotiations or deals. Well, your natural instinct is to put the other side as far as possible into a situation in which it feels vulnerable and uncertain. And precisely because the Ukrainians had actually have managed to deal really rather well with the overt military slash
better than
militias,
any of us thought they would,
sort of challenge that they face along the line of contact, they just simply had to kind of move the battlefield elsewhere.
Chris, anything to add there?
I would just say that there, when things like cyber attacks happen, especially on the days when a military intelligence colonel is killed,
and the day before Ukraine's Constitution Day,
and then the day before Ukraine's Constitution Day, for a lot of people, we say, well, I mean, we question it. Is it coincidence? And something I think that's become a little bit worrying, at least as I'm a foreign correspondent. I'm not Ukrainian, but I've been in Ukraine for a very long time. I tend to take a more kind of neutral and objective approach to all of this, but I think something that actually harms Ukraine is when something like a cyber attack or an assassination happens. And let's say in the case of one of these things, there is more, at least circumstantial evidence to point to Russia, but not necessarily the other thing. The Ukrainians have started just lumping all of that together because of this dark power that Mark is talking about, that Russia is moving toward, and the fear that's there. So it is starting to work, and they're very quick to just jump to the conclusion that Russia is behind everything, despite the fact that these things, cyber attacks, are extremely difficult to apply attribution to.
Right. Although we have applied attribution to cyber attacks in the past. We pretty much knew what happened in 2014, 2015, right? That there was enough of a consensus among the cybersecurity experts for me.
Sure, but these aren't the same kinds of hacks.
No, these are
the same kind of attacks.
These are different. Now, when this started to look like a ransomware attack, everybody's backing off, and now it doesn't look so much like a ransomware attack anymore.
Yeah. I guess my point is something that I was speaking earlier this week with a friend about, that it does more to, I mean, it detracts from the times that Russia is responsible for cyber attacks, when you just kind of lump everything into one thing. Every assassination, every murder, every cyber attack, Russia's behind it, right? It detracts if you don't have, it detracts from the moments when they are behind those things, and we have the evidence to show that they are behind those things, you know. And I think that's just something that Ukraine should be, and everybody should be a little bit more cautious
particularly
about.
Particularly in the context of, I mean, there is quite a bit of Ukraine fatigue in Europe, and to an extent also in Washington. And unfortunately, exactly, that precisely lends itself to that. You know, the people will choose to focus on the one, two, three times where people immediately said, it was the Russians, and it wasn't, rather than the four, five, six times when, in fact, it absolutely was the Russians. It provides ammunition for people who want to say, Kiev is not serious. We can't really deal with it. We should just leave it to its own devices, which is, you know, a tragedy for the Ukrainians. Mm.
Turning back to the conflict, Chris, you were just, again, we were talking off mic, you were speculating about whether the conflict could move beyond the current boundaries, the so-called DNR and the LNR. You seem very skeptical about that. What is leading you to believe that? Because you hear these rumors all the time from Ukrainians. They're going to go for Mariupol this week, you know, or they're going to go for Kharkiv next week, you know, and it never happens. Or what's your sense there?
No, I don't get the sense that the boundaries are going to move. I get the sense that there will be another escalation because historically we've seen, you know, ebbs and flows, right? And it's that hot time of year. I'm not talking about summer,
right?
I would expect something like that before the school year, right? Mm-hmm. There no doubt there will be another September 1st bell ceasefire that is right. at least agreed to, in theory, but not put into place in practice. I suppose
August seems to be the month for escalations, and
always it has been. The last 3 years. Yeah. I mean, look, there's a lot of reasons I think to, you know, for an escalation to happen, but I don't see any justification for moving the boundaries further than where they are. There has been, on the Ukrainians' part, at least, you know, and I got a lot of flack for using the term creeping offensive, although I'm not the one who came up with it. It was Ukrainian media who actually used it first. There has been a sort of creeping offensive on the Ukrainian side, but they're not creeping over the separatist borders,
right,
or front line. What they're doing is moving further into what is the gray zone, right. You know, that area, that buffer area between the two front lines, to take, they say, to take better positions, you know, from which they can defend themselves. So in some cases, where I've visited places where they've done this, it's higher ground. You know, they've got simply a better view. In other places, it's to, and I've been told this, launch an offensive if necessary. Now, that doesn't mean that they have any kind of plan to do so on the horizon, but should it come to that, they feel that having these positions that they're taking will allow them a better kind of launch point.
Right. Is the feeling that Mariupol is sufficiently fortified now?
Mariupol is got a nice buffer between Shirokina and it. There's, you know, at least 25 kilometers between there. You know, rockets fly pretty far, but it is pretty heavily fortified, and they do keep some of their premier groups, units, and fighters in Mariupol, because the Ukrainians understand the importance of Mariupol, just as they know the significance and importance of places like Avdiivka, where the coke plant, you know, that powers much of the region, is vital to its survival.
Right. All right, so on that note, we'll shift gears. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at how the authorities in Kyiv are changing their approach to the war and what that may mean. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFARL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galeotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. And also with us in the studio is RFARL's Ukraine correspondent Christopher Miller, who is fresh from a tour of the front lines in the Donbas and has a piece coming out about that tour, hopefully pretty soon. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical Podcast on iTunes, you could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org, and you could follow us on the Twitter @PowerVertical.
Власти Украины могут прекратить антитеррористическую операцию.
Александр Турчинов утверждает, что Украине нужно завершить так называемые антитеррористические
операции. Сейчас военные действия на Донбассе уже переросли масштабы антитеррористической.
So the authorities in Kyiv are apparently giving the war in the Donbass a major rethink. Legislation is reportedly being considered by the Верховна Рада that would redesignate the Ukrainian operation in the east as a local war rather than as a anti-terrorist or operation. It would also designate the territories held by pro-Moscow separatists and Russian forces as occupied territories. Chris, what is the idea behind these changes? And we don't even know there's a law yet. We just know people are talking about a law a lot in the Ukrainian media. But what is behind these changes? I get the sense there is more than semantics at work here.
There's more than semantics, but there are few details about exactly what it is they want to do. And I've actually been told that there's nothing in writing yet. If it is in writing, it's
top secret.
It's either top secret or still very much in draft form. I think what we've seen the last couple of weeks in President Poroshenko and the National Security and Defense Council Secretary Alexander Turchinov speaking publicly about these things and not necessarily making the same points is they're trying to figure out exactly what the public is willing to go along with, and kind of judging reactions, but. One thing that I do think is important is changing the designation, and I think everybody is in agreement on that the anti-terrorist operation was what it needed to be in the beginning because for political reasons, for economic reasons, for several different reasons, they could not declare war, and they still can't really do that, but they need to move away from the anti-terrorist operation for other reasons as well. One is that it limits the scope of the military operation in the East. It also means that for the last 3 years, as long as the ATO designation stays, the body in charge of the conflict is actually the Security Service of Ukraine rather than the military. So doing away with the ATO designation and actually puts the conflict under the watch of the military.
Now, why does this give I understand the shifting it from the SBU to the Defense Ministry, but why does it give the military more scope to operate in the East? Why would this designation matter?
That's a very good question. I don't have all the answers for it. Mark actually might be a better person to speak with about those kind of technical aspects. The military certainly has more resources than the Domestic Security Service. It allows them to take decisions unilaterally also give the president more say in what goes on in the East, as well as Turchinov, the National Security and Defense Council. Because right now, a lot of that is run through the Security Service just because of the ATO designation.
Well, and also, I think it gives them the ability to declare martial law, if I'm not mistaken.
Well,
if I'm judging from what I've read in the Ukrainian press.
It does.
Also.
We've effectively had martial law
in the region for the last
3 years.
It's
just
that
maybe legally, it would allow them to impose some elements of martial law that they have been unable to do so just because of this designation.
Now, the declaring the territories occupied territories, does that have any? Is there any obvious reason to do that other than the political symbolic?
I mean, I think there are international law reasons to do that, but there's also the fact that this is what much of the Ukrainian public wants. They want it to be declared occupied territory. They want designations that are a lot more clear cut and a little bit sexier for the West.
Right.
They don't like the fact that a lot of correspondents will refer to it as separatist controlled territory or separatist territory. It's very much a manufactured war, and a lot of people understand that. But it's different when when our copy gets to editors' desks. Sometimes more general terms are used. Ukrainians and the Ukrainian government hope that in passing legislation that labels officially under Ukrainian law labels these areas occupied territory, like in Crimea, that it will garner a little bit more international attention and kind of like corral everyone into using this term rather than these other kind of like vague terms that nobody really understands, I think.
Mark, what do you make of all this?
Yeah, definitely it's a long overdue revision precisely to actually sort of make the nomenclature actually fit the reality more. The notion that this is just an anti-terrorism operation was always sort of fairly threadbare, and obviously it made sense as an emergency measure at the time. But given that it's clear that this is not, unfortunately, a conflict that's going away anytime soon, it's time to regularise it. In part, absolutely, as Chris said, in terms of the optics and how it plays outside of Ukraine's borders and how you get it sort of registered into the collective consciousness. But yeah, let's talk faintly about briefly about the practical dimensions. First of all, on this whole business of actually moving effective command from the SBU to the military. I mean, first of all, there is, and it's hard to know with what accuracy, but there is a widespread perception, quite frankly, that the SBU leaks more than the military, or at least it still has much more Russian penetration than the military. There's been more of a purge of the military, and there's a general sense that this is the case. We'll wait and see if it's true or not. But at least I think part of that is precisely a sense that, in fact, the Russians have been able to essentially always, or it seems to be, you know, pretty much always, know in advance if there's any kind of major sort of shifts on the Ukrainian side. And combined with that, look, the Ukrainian military actually has the experience and the expertise in how you handle large-scale combined arms operations, which you would need either A, for this someday offensive to take back the Donbass, but more to the point, you would certainly need, if the Russians ever actually chose to escalate this and move it from a semi-proxy, semi-mercenary war to a full-scale, you know, if they did, for example, decide to take Mariupol, it would not be with a bunch of guys in trucks and Cossack hats. They would have to be deploying battalion tactical groups, plus they'd actually be having to... Air power, that's one thing they haven't yet really moved to. That's, in a way, one of their aces in ace cards, so we'll see. But certainly, massed artillery of the sort that actually has been tremendously effective. But particularly, we would see the combination of artillery and armour. Mm. And again, to deal with that, you need to have people who are trained in that kind of thing. So I think it is shifting command to the people who actually have the competence. On this business of martial law, I think the idea is, and again, we're all just kind of reading small scatters of bits of entrails.
Since there's nothing in writing yet.
Yeah, but, you know, just hints, I think, that the problem is at the moment that the martial law guidelines are actually quite broad brush. You can basically declare martial law in the region or not, or in the country or not. I think the idea is that as part and parcel of this, they would create the capacity to actually sort of make it more granular in terms of the areas, and possibly also in terms of the different forms. You know, that actually they might have different levels, shall I say, of martial law. And that also has impacts in terms of the balance of practical use and political power between the military and the National Guard. I think the military are wanting to reassert their overall control. And although the National Guard, there is a clear high level of coordination. I mean, Chris will be able to speak more to this, actually how it works on the front line or doesn't. But in theory, there's a high level of coordination. I think in practice, the military think there's not enough, and they want to create a situation in which it's very clear that basically everyone, from the SBU to the National Guard, is part of a military-controlled structure.
Led by the Defense Ministry.
Absolutely.
Right.
Or the General Staff.
Or the General Staff, right. Now, behind all of this, Ukraine seems to be increasingly confident that it's going to get some sort of Western support, probably in the form of defensive weapons. This is something Ukraine's wanted for some time. What is the source of this? Chris, first of all, are you seeing this in Ukraine? I see it in public statements from Poroshenko, but when you talk to people on the ground there, do they really think this is coming? And is there any reason to think that these hopes are realistic, and if so, why?
Well, it seems the presidential administration and the MFA, the foreign ministry, and some of those in the military I've spoken to in rather senior positions are convinced that they're going to get lethal weapons, and they've made public statements before about U.S. support and the hope of lethal weapons. But they're speaking about it with a strange confidence this time that I don't fully understand. Mm-hmm. Nothing has been made public from the American side that leads us to believe that they're going to actually provide
even
lethal weapons.
At.
No, I mean, you know, we've seen support from Congress before, but that has not led.
No, it doesn't count if John McCain says it. It counts if Mattis says it.
Exactly. So I don't know where this confidence comes from. One interesting thing I would say we should keep an eye on is whatever this U.S. defense agreement with Ukraine is. There was a little bit after Trump's meeting with Poroshenko in Washington that came out about some kind of deal where maybe American defense contractors would be providing something to Ukraine in the future. And there are some Mattis is coming supposed to come to Ukraine within the next couple of months. The energy minister is coming. Perry's coming to Kiev in a couple of months. So there's some kind of mutually beneficial deals being made. And I can just guess that Kiev seems to think that one of those deals is going to be an arms deal. Mm-hmm. I don't see it happening. No matter what the U.S. is willing to give, Russia is willing to give more.
Well, this is something that's coming up again and again and again when we discuss this issue, the old escalation dominance argument,
exactly.
Right? And this is why even military people that I've spoken to said it's a bad idea to do this because Russia's going to give more. It's precisely escalation dominance.
There were a lot of other reasons earlier on, too, right? Like the military was in pretty bad shape. Kalashnikovs. Yeah. They couldn't even find their way around a rifle.
Now that's not the case. They're
much more skilled and disciplined.
No, they could. I mean, I'm sure they could handle the weapons. But the question is, what does that do in terms of the escalation of the conflict? Mark, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, the discussion about lethal weapons almost invariably defaults down to the Javelin missile.
Right.
Which is this has acquired this kind of totemic mythical symbolism,
yeah.
Exactly. As well, I mean, first of all, were I a cynic, I would wonder how far this is fueled by exceedingly effective lobbying by the producers.
But of course, all know you're not a cynic.
Exactly, no. I mean, so let us throw that to one side. No, I mean, look, would the Javelin provide substantially greater anti-armor capability for the Ukrainian forces? Yes, absolutely. And definitely, I mean, this is a battlefront in which actually tank warfare is indeed a possibility. I think I would say really that the true impact, I think, would be more symbolic, or rather I'd hope it would be more symbolic. It would precisely be a step forward. It's something that, you might say, Ukraine has, from the first, been looking for from the West and above all from the United States, and the United States has rightly been hesitant. If this time the United States says, fair enough, have some missiles, it says something, I mean, that firstly, it's something that Poroshenko can say to the Ukrainians, I have managed to secure this expansion in foreign support. Secondly, it would say something to the Russians, I think the Ukrainians hope, that in fact, despite all the talk of a Trump White House being lukewarm about supporting Ukraine, one way or the other, the American government absolutely is still committed.
Right.
But on the ground, absolutely, I think, yes, of course, it will give certain capabilities. If the Javelin were used in combat against Russian tanks, though, it would also give the Russians excellent opportunities to precisely see how their tanks fare against the Javelin, and so they can work out how to up-armour it. And I would also add that I would be amazed if they weren't able to procure several missiles from the forces. Again, I mean, that's just the way things are, or whatever. I mean, if they could and did steal sidewinders from Western forces during the Cold War, I think they could probably get a Javelin or two.
Well, a couple of anti-mortar radars during
exactly.
this conflict.
Yeah, so. Precisely. So it's all good for them. But yeah, I mean, the key thing is this. In some ways, it would worry me because there are people in Kiev who are worryingly gung-ho, who are talking about, some kind of... I mean, I'm not saying they honestly believe they can take back all of the occupied territories. But, I think there are people who are hungry for some sense of a real victory. And a victory does not just simply mean we repulsed this particular company-level sort of thrust or whatever. So it might empower then. And absolutely, I mean, the Russians are not going to sit back and say, oh, no, what a shame. You know, again, maybe they will be thinking, OK, so let's now admix a little bit of air power. And all of a sudden, you'd suddenly have some, you know, ground attack aircraft or attack helicopters appearing with DNR logos on
the side.
And
then there'll be pressure to give them stingers.
Or something like that. Yeah, exactly. I mean, but the point is, you know, the Russians can always sort of upgrade in this respect. Now, that's not a kind of counsel for despair. It just means this idea that there is a magic missile which is going to somehow dramatically change the situation on the ground, I think is a dangerous one for everyone concerned.
Any thoughts on why the Ukrainian authorities seem to be, as Chris notes, more confident now that these weapons are coming, whether or not it's a good idea to get them?
Maybe they think that this is an American administration which is actually more partial to the impact of lobbying from extremely well-funded arms companies than the previous one. Who can tell? I mean, they'll have to answer that one, not me.
One last thing I wanted to hit on before we wrapped it up is Minsk. We haven't talked a lot about Minsk. It's fascinating.
Good reason.
It's fascinating to say Minsk is dead,
but yet
nobody will admit it except us. I mean, no officials will admit this. Where does this go now? I mean, what is all this? What does post Minsk look like? Or if we believe Emmanuel Macron, he wants to reanimate Minsk, judging from his comments yesterday.
I think, yeah, there's some hope that it can be reanimated. I don't think anybody likes thinking about what post Minsk looks like, because while Minsk is buried, dead, gone, not going to be revived, I think. It still works in favor of everyone to keep it around, because nobody has any, you know, solutions or better answers as to what exactly to do to bring an end to the conflict. Obviously, there are certain people who are not really going to budge on some things and make difficult concessions that are required for this.
It's almost surreal. I mean, because the Normandy format meetings keep going on. You keep having calls from all sides for the other side to obey Minsk, and from the West for both sides to adhere to Minsk. And yet, meanwhile, as you say, if you go to the front lines, they're still fighting. Right? There's no. It's really, really surreal. Mark, what do you make of this?
Oh, it's a ghastly example of much of the sort of the worst of modern diplomacy. It was a deal that should not have been struck. Just that when you have powerful people coming together saying, we're here to create an agreement, it's very hard for them to actually leave with their tail between their legs, saying, oops, we tried, but we failed. So this is a classic case of just, you know, that they felt something was better than nothing. I don't agree, and I don't actually think, I mean, as was the case, that Kyiv should not have been pressurized into basically signing it. Because above all, the only real beneficiaries are the Russians. Because precisely it gives them a spurious basis on which they can say, well, we may not be, but nor are they. It gives them kind of a fake moral equivalence. Again, back to this business of rather than just thinking, well, one side's the invader and the other side is not. But, I mean, going back to, I mean, this notion of reviving it, kind of Frankenstein's peace deal, coming kind of groaning and roaring out of the grave, does not really fill me with great confidence. And I come back to saying, well, actually, I honestly believe that at the moment, no accord is better than a bad accord. Because there is absolutely no evidence that this acts in any way to restrain what's going on the ground. It doesn't in any way create some kind of meaningful sort of peace conversation.
Let me start. It did fix the line of contact, though. That's, if you want to say there's one thing it did.
I mean, not necessarily, because, you know, the way it was drawn up, I think, you know, Ukraine was supposed to be granted to Baltsava, depending on who you talk to, but I think so, and some other places. So, I mean, it solidified it, but it took a little bit of time, right? I mean, the battle for Baltsava happened actually after the accord was signed.
But it's not as if the line is there because of the Minsk Accord. The line is there because there are Ukrainian soldiers dug in who, day in, day out, are defending it. And because Moscow is not willing to put the kind of resources that will be needed to push the line back, but on the other hand is willing to surge in, if necessary, resources to hold the line against Ukrainian sort of pushes. And, you know, it's actually the arithmetic of the battlefield that keeps the line there, not the Minsk Accord. I'm not going to give Minsk even that.
Why do you hate Minsk so much? So where do we? So what now? You say no accord's better than a bad accord.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem is precisely all these attempts to basically retrofit onto an existing structure. I think so much better than simply say Minsk didn't work. Let's get rid of it. And then if further down the line we can actually organically create a real peace accord, which actually, let's be honest, will require Moscow to have some desire to have peace. And the problem is that
Moscow does not have that desire.
Putin cannot withdraw with anything other than a mission accomplished moment. He needs to be able to say, we went in to do a certain purpose, we've accomplished it, everything's fine, we won, so we can now pull out. Kiev cannot and will not give him that.
But I think it even goes beyond the symbolic aspect. It's if Moscow's not going to pull out unless it is assured that it will have a beachhead of influence in Ukraine. That's what this is all about.
It was all about. I'm honestly,
you think they would be willing to?
I just remember talking to someone from the Russian Foreign Ministry when I was in Moscow who said, look, this is very much a Moscow perspective. I'm not endorsing it. But, you know, we should have realized that the Ukraine's going to screw this up themselves. We really should not have got involved. We should have just sat back and let it happen. Now, OK, I think obviously the situation is rather different now. But I think given how much they're having to pay to keep the Donbass existing, you know, sort of invisible subsidies, plus all the military dimension, I think, frankly, if they could get a deal, especially if there was a deal that in some ways would, if not formally, but in some ways kind of nudge towards a sanctification of their seizure of Crimea, I think that they would go for that and just rely on economic connectivities and their assumptions about what the Ukrainians are going to do to maintain their influence.
Chris, any last thoughts from you before we wrap it up and send you back to the Donbass?
I'm not going to pretend like I have any better solutions, to end this thing. But I'll say something that maybe some will consider to be controversial. But the people who are taking decisions on this and are considering some solutions might want to spend a little bit more time speaking with those who are directly affected. In eastern Ukraine,
on the front lines,
Like, yeah, they feel voiceless and unheard, I think that's something their thoughts and feelings should definitely be magnified in this.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're all looking forward to your piece, which we hope will be out sometime soon. And on that note, we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me in the studio has been co-host Mark Eliade, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations at Prague, head of its Center for European Security, and a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations. Also with us in the studio has been RFERL's Ukraine correspondent Christopher Miller, fresh back from a tour of the front lines in the Donbass. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFRL.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. The Power Vertical podcast will not appear next week as I will be traveling to Riga for a couple of public speaking engagements, but bear with us, we'll be back. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.